Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that loves every once in a while to go old school. And I mean that in the sense of looking back at films that we've seen, some we've nearly forgotten, some we've never been tempted to forget, but all that we think are worth a second appraisal. They're films that may never have gotten a lot of attention from the general public, but in each of our minds, certainly deserve it. We like to call them buried or forgotten treasures. Each of us will share two films, and since we haven't revealed them to each other, there's just as much chance that we'll argue as we'll agree. Anyway, let me start off. I realized that when I chose the two movies that I wanted to feature, that both of them ultimately had something in common, and that is that they portray people in a realistic manner. I mean, we talk about reality television, but these movies put us in these people's lives, and it's not something that we normally see. The first movie I'm going to talk about is American Movie, the 1999 documentary directed by Chris Smith, which is Smith's attempt to delve into the world of a guy named Mark Borchardt, who is an obsessive filmmaker, but who's never made a film. He's been struggling for years to make a movie called Northwestern. He doesn't have any money. He can't pay his taxes. He owes child support. He's drunk half the time. His friends are all druggies. I mean, it's incredible. And he decides that he's going to finish this short to try to make money out of it so it'll fund his movie Northwestern. And the movie, he calls it Coven, even though it should be Coven, but he doesn't want to.
Coven sounds like oven, man.
He doesn't want that. What I find amazing is the delving into Borchardt's life. I mean, he is a real person, not the kind that we see in reality television, not the kind that we see in movies at all. This is how people really are. And looking back, seeing the movie a second time or a third time, I hadn't realized that it's funny in parts, but it's also really sad in parts too. And it's ultimately revealing about a part of America that most of us don't want to see, or we don't see certainly on any television or movies.
Well, I'm tempted to just not even talk about my picks and just talk about American Movie for the rest of the show.
We could.
Because I don't know if you know this, but American Movie is one of my maybe five or six favorite movies ever.
I don't know. That
I've
list keeps growing and growing. Your top five list
This would be in my all-time favorite top 10. How's that?
Okay, fair enough.
I have seen it maybe 50 times. I quote it constantly. And I agree with you that not only is it hilarious, but it is heartbreaking in a lot of ways, but weirdly inspiring too.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people think of this movie as sort of looking down its nose at these people. And I think it is deeply affectionate about a very irascible character, Mark Borchardt. And I even have his film Coven on VHS autographed by him. That's how big of a fan of this movie I am.
Thanks
love,
to your wife.
Yeah, she got it for me for Christmas. I love American Movie. Great pick.
Well, I'm going to delve into a territory that's quite a contrast to American Movie. And I've talked about this film at least once before, but it still resonates for me. And even though it is 40-some years old, I still think that it holds up. And that film is Dutch filmmaker Marleen Gorris's Question of Silence. And it's,
what year?
I think it's 1982 that it was filmed.
Okay.
I think it was released in 83. But some people might think that this is a powerful feminist movie, and others might feel differently about it. But basically, the plot line is there are three women, unknown to each other, in a store, and the male proprietor comes over and accuses one of the women of shoplifting. And so the women, without any sort of verbal communication whatsoever, suddenly kill the shopkeeper. And so it seems mysterious on one level, but not. And then after they're incarcerated, a female psychiatrist who's struggling to really appreciate fully what happened starts interviewing one of the women in particular. But it's sort of a commentary on what was happening during that time period. But again, I think it still holds up. You know, maybe we would have to transfer the setting to cyberspace or something. But I think that, you know, there's this bond, this camaraderie, this understanding. But at the same time, why did it have to take the form that it did? And that's the struggle that the psychiatrist is sort of dealing with in her conversations or therapy sessions with the perpetrators. And I don't know. It still resonates for me. And I think it was the way that it was made, number one. But I don't know. Nathan, are you intrigued?
Yes. And you have brought this movie up, Question of Silence, it's called. You've brought this movie up to me before. And I had never heard of it until you brought it up. But when you described the plot, I said, that's something I would like to see. I really love, well, not always, but I love a premise that begins with an unexplained event or someone acting in an unusual way. And then the rest of the plot kind of unfolds from there about why this person did what they did, or maybe even if they did the thing. I'm thinking, of course, most recently of Anatomy of a Fall. It sounds like they have a lot in common. And so even though you have recommended it to me before, I have yet to check this out. I did look it up. And it's streaming on the Criterion channel. So if you have a subscription to that, you can watch it, as well as American Movie. They have that on Criterion, and it's free on Tubi, which is my favorite streaming service because it's free. And they have lots of weird stuff on there. So I might actually have to check it out finally.
I've never seen the film either. And as a matter of fact, I don't even remember Mary Pat ever talking about this movie. But I have to say that it sounds like a movie that might have inspired Rosie Glass, who directed Love Lies Bleeding, which is a movie that we talked about
last
in a
week,
recent
yeah.
show. So I don't know if it would be an enjoyable evening, but it might be an eye-opening
evening. I'm adding
evening.
It to my queue.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess it's my turn. I'm going to take us back even further into the past. My first choice for a buried treasure is from 1955.
Oh, my.
And it's an MGM musical. It's called It's Always Fair Weather. This was the final collaboration between Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly after they made On the Town and Singin' in the Rain. And by all accounts, they hated each other by the end of this production because it was apparently a very troubled production. And they never made another movie together again, which is sort of a small tragedy. But it's about these three GIs played by Kelly, Dan Daly, and Michael Kidd. And they come home from World War II. They're the closest of friends. And they make a pact that 10 years from now, they're all going to meet up and just catch up. And so when they finally do, they find out that that spark that made them friends in the first place is totally gone, and they actually hate each other now. And so the rest of the movie is sort of about them coming to terms with the fact that they've changed, that time has passed, that all of these things that they thought they were going to do with their lives maybe never came to pass. So it's this weirdly cynical film, despite it being a big, splashy MGM musical. And it was a financial failure at the time. I don't know if it was because of that cynicism or just because the country's affection for big musicals like that was kind of coming to an end. America's love of musicals ebbs and flows and always will. And the reason I picked It's Always Fair Weather, first of all, it's not nearly as famous as the other two Don and Kelly collaborations, especially Singin' in the Rain.
No, I don't know how I ever missed this. I mean, I've seen the other two.
Yeah, really.
Amazing movie. I only saw it recently and I thought, where has this movie been my entire life? I love it so much.
And how did you see it?
It was on the Criterion channel.
Okay.
I looked it up now. It's not there anymore, but you can rent it anywhere. It's on all of the digital platforms for like $4 if you rent it. But it is a hugely entertaining movie. There are all of these wonderful musical numbers. There's one where Gene Kelly does a dance number. It's pretty much a recreation of his central Singing in the Rain bit, but he does it on roller skates. There's a scene with Sid Charisse in a boxing gym that's a lot of fun. Dolores Gray kind of has the Gene Hagen role in this. And it's also a commentary not only on this sort of post-war malaise that was going on in the country. It's also kind of a satire of the nascent television, quote-unquote, fad at the time, and it's making fun of advertising and television and image and all of that. There's so much going on in this movie, and I kind of understand why it was a bust at the time. I mean, it's downbeat, and it just wasn't in vogue at the time. But if you've never seen It's Always Fair Weather or you haven't seen it in a while— man, there are moments where it's almost as great as Singin' in the Rain. It's so good.
That sounds like a great trilogy.
Yes.
Singin' in the Rain.
Yeah. On the Town.
On the Town.
And this.
Yeah.
And also, you know, all three movies in one way or another about male friendship.
Yeah.
And
On
the
Town,
Town
especially.
And,
yes.
And supposedly this was originally kind of envisioned as a sort of sequel to On the Town because you've got the three soldiers.
Right.
But it takes on an entirely different
tack. Three sailors in On the Town.
Exactly. Yeah. So it takes on an entirely different tack. But yeah, I just think this is one of those movies that needs, I don't know, just a lot more attention. I think it is a genuine classic and one of the great musicals, one of the greatest ever made, I think.
Yeah. Well, that was the first half of this special Buried Treasures or Forgotten Treasures episode of Movies 101. I'll go back and talk about them. I had the movie American Movie, the 1999 film by Chris Smith. Mary Pat had
A Question of Silence.
by something in 1982 or 83.
Yep. Marlene Gorris.
And Nathan?
It's Always Fair Weather from 1955.
Okay. All of those are available on some streaming service or other. It's time to take a short break now, though. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to list more of our personal recommendations for great, or at least greatish, cinema. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Wherever life takes you, take Spokane Public Radio with you. You can stream your favorite public radio station on your smartphone, computer, smart speaker, or any mobile device. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and click Listen Live. Pick KPBX, KSFC, or KPBZ and start listening. Or just ask your Amazon Echo or Google Home smart speaker to play Spokane Public Radio. Listen live to Spokane Public Radio at work, home, or wherever you go.
Peter Sagal here from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. If you're a member of this NPR station, thank you. It means a lot. Now, if you were looking for another way to help the station, you could, I don't know, call up all your friends and ask them to donate on your behalf repeatedly at all hours of the day and night until they just give in to get rid of you or block your number. Or you could just donate a vehicle you no longer need. It's up to you. Annoy your friends or free up space in your garage. Your choice.
Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I each shared a film that we think every movie fan should see at least once, though some of us have seen our choices multiple times. Let's continue our list of what we like to call buried or forgotten treasures by turning to Mary Pat. Why don't you start us off this time?
Well, I think you're going to wonder what I found in both of my choices to be treasures, so to speak, because I can't really put them into that category. But films that people should see, in my opinion, and the one that I've chosen this time is Once Were Warriors, and it's a 1994 New Zealand film. Some listeners in the audience might remember that it was shown at the Magic Lantern during that time period, and
we actually had a
fundraiser for the YWCA domestic violence program, and people found it to be very difficult to watch. So I'm just warning folks.
Yeah, it's a trigger warning. Yeah.
But I think that it is about a relationship of a woman who grows up in this Maori village and then moves to Auckland with her husband, who is very abusive. And it's about their family. It's about poverty. It's about violence. But it's also, the more that I've thought about it since I saw it originally, because again, we're talking about something from 30 years ago, it's also a commentary on the sort of effect of the colonizers. And so I think this film operates on multiple levels. And having seen it after we went to New Zealand, and we think that, oh, well, New Zealand today is really trying to honor its Maori culture and heritage. And, you know, we have museums and signs and things in both languages, and we're treating our history respectfully, and we're willing to, you know, show what happened back in the day. I don't think that's true. And I think that this film really does show on different levels the problems that people face that are universal, and also the problems that might be specific to this particular locale.
We need to point out that Once Were Warriors is a movie that introduced us to Temuera Morrison, who's a well-known now. He's in the most recent Aquaman. He was on Boba Fett on the Disney Channel. He's been in a number of movies, but this was the first time, and he came on the screen immediately, and you went, whoa, there's star power here.
Well, and it was directed by Lee Tamahori, who's had a really interesting career since, because he's mostly made big budget action movies.
Right.
Like, I think he directed one of the James Bond movies and Triple X State of the Union, that one. I also think Once Were Warriors is about all the things that you mentioned, but it's also very much about the effects of abuse on children. And because a lot of this movie is from the perspective of the kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're sort of our entry point into the story. And so it's very perceptive
about that.
Because
the girl keeps a journal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also we can see how it forces her to form relationships, you know, with other children who might be similarly situated.
Yeah, and we should say, too, that it's available to stream on Canopy, the library's app, if you have that, but it's also available to rent anywhere. I think that's a really good choice. Once Were Warriors, a really strong film.
Why don't you go next, Nathan?
All right. Well, I didn't exactly come up with sort of a unifying theme for the two movies I picked. I just kind of picked two movies I wanted to talk about. And so this has nothing to do with 1950s MGM musicals. But my choice, my other choice for a buried treasure, is a 1985 British drama called Weatherby, which is streaming now on Tubi. That's how I saw it. And it's the first film directed by Sir David Hare, the playwright. He's probably best known for writing the screenplay for The Hours and plays like Heavy. I think that's probably his most famous play. But this is sort of how it starts. It's set in this sleepy British village, and it opens with a dinner party. And this young man shows up at the dinner party, and everyone there kind of thinks that someone else has brought him along as their guest. But really,
I remember
have you
this
seen
film.
This? But
yes.
Really, he doesn't know anybody there. And then the next day, he returns to the house and shoots himself in front of the woman that lives in that house. She's played by Vanessa Redgrave. And so the rest of the movie is kind of about the fallout from that incident. And some of the people in this town look at the death as a mystery. Others look at it as a random act of violence. And Hare kind of lets us see into some of these people's past. We even see sort of what this young man did in the days leading up to his death. We even get to kind of eavesdrop on all of the relationships and marriages going on in this town. And it just kind of pushes us even further from the truth of why this person would do this thing in front of this
gathering stranger.
Yes. And so this is just a really haunting movie. And I think it captures better than a lot of films about, you know, similar subjects, the kind of claustrophobia of small town life. Weatherby is the name of the village in which it's set. And I also have to mention the cast of this movie is just stacked.
Vanessa Redgrave?
I mean, not only Vanessa Redgrave, but Judi Dench, Ian Holm, Jolie Richardson, who's playing the younger version of her mother, and Tom Wilkinson, who we lost earlier this year. So this is one of those movies that I've heard about for a long time, and I put it on one night, and it sucked me in instantly. I had to see how it ended. It's just, and it has such a great visual sense,
too. And what year was this?
1985.
Okay, because I'm trying
Weatherby,
to figure
it's
out.
Called.
For some reason, I think I saw it in New York. Hmm. And I was living on the East Coast at that time. But you're right. I mean, the star power alone. And also, it is a commentary on, we think of these idyllic little English villages.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're used to seeing them in, maybe in this mystery setting or in these comedic settings. And this just shows you.
Yes, it shatters the quaintness. And I'm sure Martin McDonagh, also a playwright, is a big fan of this movie. You can see a lot of its DNA in his work. But if you haven't seen Weatherby, I suggest you check it out. But again, very much a downer, but really, really worth seeing.
Well, you know, you've thrown down the gauntlet. I mean, the challenges out there now, you've mentioned two movies that I have not seen. And that is pretty...
That's the point of the show, right?
That was a pretty good achievement by you. And the next time we do one of these shows, I am going to go way back and find something you've never even heard of. Yeah,
I mean, Mary Pat had one that I still haven't seen. So
right. You know. Well, all right. So that leaves the final one up to me. And I look back all the way to not 1985, but 1986. Mm. And that was the little self-absorbed documentary memoir called Sherman's March, and by a guy named Ross McElwee. And Ross McElwee has made, over the years since then, this was like his fifth film. He's made 10 overall, and he's taught film at various places. He's taught it, I think the most recent place he taught at was, of all places, a little college called Harvard. I'm not sure any of you have even heard of it, but...
Rings a bell.
You know...
I think it's the Gonzaga of the East.
I think you're right. Absolutely. Except not as good a basketball team. Mm. Sherman's March. Now, there are other movies called Sherman's March, so you got to search this one out.
Right, right. I was going to say...
That are actually about Sherman's March? Yeah.
This one starts off. The first minute or so is in this sonorous voice coming on talking about General William Tecumseh Sherman and his march through the South in 1864, but then very quickly it becomes, the camera turns to Ross McElwee himself, and he's talking about, well, you know, I'm starting to make this movie, and the movie then becomes 2.5 hours of him going back and forth between, I'm trying to make this movie about Sherman, but I'm also looking for women in my life, and he goes from one relationship to the next. And
interesting juxtaposition.
You know, here's what I wrote. In his film, which meanders through the South, much as Sherman did, McElwee introduces us to one character after the next, from the actress Pat, who does her cellulite exercises, his sister, who details her recent operations, including a fanny tuck, The linguist Winnie, with whom he has a short affair, to his former teacher Charlene, who tries to set him up and tells him to shut off his camera. "This is not art, Ross. This is life," she tells him. All the people are, again, as real as can be. So real that if they were in a movie, we'd think they were complete fakes. But that is life. And I just, not everyone is going to like Sherman's March. You're going to go, after a while, I'm bored. I mean, what is going on in this guy's life?
Why should I care about this guy?
Right. But I was fascinated by Sherman's March.
It's a great pairing with American Movie, actually, because
absolutely,
I think both are kind of getting at the same thing, which is examining certain kinds of American experiences and even, I mean, American history in the case of Sherman's March by way of these very specific people living these very specific lives and kind of digging into the minutiae of those lives.
And the minutiae of Southern life itself.
Yeah.
He was born, I think, in Charleston, South Carolina, raised there. And so there is, it's a road movie in the sense that he gets his brother's old beat up MG and he's driving through the South. He hits Atlanta. He does try to take the same path that Sherman took in 1864. But while Sherman was looking through the wreckage of the South during the war, he's looking through the wreckage of his life, of his
relationships. Yeah, and I think that this movie, Sherman's March, it's definitely ahead of its time in terms of, you know, a filmmaker turning his camera on himself. But I mean, it's almost like this could have been like a Live Journal blog at some point, or like a series of YouTube videos.
Absolutely.
You know, it's very much ahead of its time in that. I have not seen this in a long time, but I do remember enjoying it a lot. It is streaming for free, again, on Canopy.
Mm-hmm. I saw it on Prime, but I had to get a Furbo account.
Well, you don't have to do that if you have Canopy, so that's
true.
Great about
that's
that. But
true.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check this out again because I remember thinking it was very intriguing.
Mm-hmm. And with that, we come to the end of this special edition of Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and throughout the show, Nathan Weinbend and Marie-Pat Truthart and I discussed films that we consider buried or forgotten treasures. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, and we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from none other than John Wick himself, Keanu Reeves. The whole aspect of cinema and film festivals should be a moment to come together and celebrate art and humanity. It would be a shame if there was such a divide. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.